Hey, everybody. Good morning. Welcome. Greetings from Atlantic City, where I'm at the Northeast Debt Collection Conference here. Having a great time so far. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I want to welcome you to today's webinar on policies and procedures versus standard operating procedures and statements of work, what should go into each. Policies and procedures are the overarching documents that govern how things are done in the collection business. But beyond that, operations also have statements of work and standard operating procedures. Figuring out what goes where is crucial to making sure an operation is as effective and has all its bases covered. So today in this webinar, which is being sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning, we've got a panel of experts here to talk about the different types of documents and what should go into each. As I mentioned, this webinar is being sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning. Peak Revenue Learning's knowledge source will help you take advantage of the spacing and testing effects. These concepts are proven to be among the most effective methods of learning improvement and knowledge retention. The focused iteration training capabilities of Knowledge Source will have a major impact on employee understanding and application of the skills required to collect more money and the laws and related policies and procedures staff members must be compliant with. You can learn more by visiting them at peakrevenuelearning.com. And we're going to hear from Mackenzie from Peak Revenue Learning a little later in our program. Let me introduce you now to our panelists. LaDonna Bowling has more than 20 years of operational and compliance experience in third-party debt collections, experience in all verticals serving creditors and debt buyers. LaDonna is a certified instructor for ACA International and currently sits on its board of directors. As the owner and president of Armed Compliance Business Solutions, Sarah Wagerman works with organizations to drive compliant business practices through her consulting solutions. Sarah's personalized approach prepares financial institutions for regulatory examinations, managing litigation risk, and improving the consumer experience. Sarah is known for her passion in helping companies overcome their unique compliance and operational challenges through delivery of compliance risk assessments, policy development, service provider management and oversight, and executive level training programs designed to help financial services companies mitigate risk and maximize effectiveness. Our format for today's webinar, it will be a panel discussion. As always, that means questions from those of you who are watching us live are encouraged. To submit a question, you can drop it right in the chat or send it through the Q&A and we'll get it asked and answered. I'll remind everybody, if you prefer to have your name not associated with a particular question or comment, use the Q&A option, click the anonymous button, and anything you send this way is done so anonymously. Unfortunately, Deborah Siski had a last minute scheduling conflict and isn't going to be able to join us today. All right, let's start by, I think, defining the topics we're going to be discussing. So to you, Sarah, since you logged on first, I'm going to make you go first. What are the differences between policies and procedures and statements of work?
So your policies are where you're going to make executive level decisions, right? So you're going to say, this is how we are going to do X, Y, and Z. For example, when there's when a law is ambiguous, right, or maybe you made it taken a stance that you're going to take this approach to make sure that, say, I'm going to use a simple example, saying the full mini Miranda on every call instead of just on the initial communication using the debt collector disclosure, subsequent communications. Let's say that your stance is we're going to put the full mini Miranda on every document where it's required and on every phone call. That is a company policy decision at that point, right? So your policies are where you assert what your standards are. So that's where your executive management team needs to come into play and help you make, you know, you need to collectively make those decisions. The mini Miranda was a really simple one, but there's, you know, when you start talking about digital communications, this becomes even more important, right? This is how we're going to handle our email communications. This is how we're going to handle text communications. These are your company statements. Your procedures are where you state how you're going to do that, right? So what are you going to do to make sure that you say the mini Miranda on every call or that you obtain consent to text message, things like that. And then you use statements of work. Some people use work instructions. Some people say job aids. This is your most grant. This is like your training documents, right? This is the click here, go to this screen. This is your very detailed work instructions for for your team?
Excellent. Thank you very much. I think using the Mini Miranda is a great example because I think everyone's familiar with it and everyone, you know, immediately identifies with it. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. LaDonna, to you, you know, do you have any differences in your definitions between policies, procedures, and statements of work, or do they line up pretty close to what Sarah laid out?
Policies and procedures do, but statement of work to me means something entirely different. You know, statement of work is what I sign with my client, you know, mm-hmm. that sets out work requirements, performance standards, those things. So, you know, I go policies, procedures, and work instructions. So I can see where, you know, people will, you know, call a statement of work a work instruction. But, you know, in my world, it means something entirely different and is usually just the work requirements set out by the client. You know, like you will make your first outbound call within 72 hours of placement and you will answer all phone calls, you know, within, you know, 30 seconds, et cetera.
But I think that leads to a really good question with that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you up. So I agree. When I saw the phrasing of statement of work from Mike, I thought the same thing, client expectations. So maybe this is, you know, from your experience, how do you weave client statements of work into your policies, procedures, and work instructions? How do you integrate? Because clients vary on how risk tolerant or adverse they are, what they want you to do. How do you weave that in?
Usually we have a work instruction that's specific for that particular client and, of course, customized training for that particular client.
Okay.
Because you know, we have some clients, you know, where we credit report, we don't credit report. They, you know, want specific things or they want, you know, another piece of information added to the right party identification. So those things are added into the work to the work instructions. And then sometimes we will, you know, just have that blanket statement in our policies, you know, to meet, you know, regulatory guidelines, client expectations, et cetera. And I feel like when you label it in general terms like that, it kind of covers you. And then you can get very specific, you know, down the line with your procedures and your work instructions.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but just sort of listening to the two of you so far, there's really not a black and white definition for policies and procedures, work statements, you know, statements of work. Does that cause problems for companies in the industry that there isn't necessarily sort of a bright line definition for those? Or is it really up to each individual company to sort of determine, you know, how they're going to define each of those? And as long as they have definitions, then really and sort of can explain what those definitions are, that's really the most important aspect of it.
I think that a policy, you know, the general definition is the same across all industries, you know, all agencies, and the same thing with procedures when you just look at the baseline definition of it. You know, then it gets not black and white when you have to make these policies and procedures unique for your organization. You know, like a 500-seat call center policy is going to be different than, you know, someone else with, you know, 15 employees or 10 employees. So that's where it gets unique when you are customizing them for your organization. And I see you nodding your head, Sarah, because you know I'm right, right?
Yeah, no. It's also, I think, where the I don't think it's the definitions that cause bottlenecks. It's the ability to actually break down what you do. The ability to have one person, at least one person, most people would like to have multiple people, right, who understand how to write and articulate this stuff in a document that can become discoverable. And I know we'll talk about that later, right? But there is kind of an art form to writing a policy and a procedure. Work instructions, you get a lot of leeway there, right? But it's really, I think that's really the challenge, is how to make them meaningful enough to where they actually are helpful and they tell people what the expectations are of the company.
Yeah. And it's funny you should say that, because I've tried to empower people through the years, you know, like, okay, client services manager, take this, you know, educate them on how to write policies, how to write procedures. And then when something happens, I'm like, all right, write a new policy for that. And they just look at me. So I found that I tend to write most of the policies and then give them to the department heads to say, and then very granular with them on the procedures and stuff, just to, and then on the C level, it's just hard sometimes I have to break it down into layman's terms for certain executives who are very far removed to understand. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, so what's a hunting, you know?
Right, yeah. I think that's the number one challenge. And so my tip to overcome that is to create some kind of a worksheet for procedure specifically. So a lot of times when we go into an organization, from my, you know, consulting side, it's like, okay, can you outline what you are doing? Who's touching it? Who's responsible for what? If part of the challenge can still become, sometimes it's like, well, we never assigned responsibility for this. This is a great opportunity for you to close gaps, right? Because you need to have that of responsibility assigned. And so creating some kind of a worksheet of step one, step two, step three, and then what are you doing here? And then having, if LaDonna is going to be the point person, to make it pretty and put it in the nice document and articulate it all, it gives LaDonna an outline of what's actually happening. And then she can say, whoa, hold up, we seem to be missing something here. Or why are we doing it this way? And ask those questions. And you can actually close gaps when you're making these, you know, formalizing your documentation in this way, which is always a good idea.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said, I'll write the policies, and then that's just the easiest way I found. Mm-hmm. Is I write them and then have someone else tell me, you missed something. And I'm like, okay, well, why are we doing it that way?
Do you find that there's a decent back and forth that goes on? I mean, are you looking for a compromise, or is it, you know, someone's got to be right, someone's got to be wrong?
I don't want to.
You can give the lawyerly answer, it depends.
Well, I know it really does depend, and I don't want to let people see the bad side of me, but the buck stops with me. You know, I consider myself the expert on regulations and within our organization, and then I got a network of people that I can always get to back me up. So I'm like, no, well, you know, Sarah says this, Deborah says this, you know, and, you know, they're the gurus in compliance. So I'm going to go with what they say and not you.
All right. We're just going to hit the pause button briefly on a conversation. I want to invite Mackenzie Rickman from Peak Revenue Learning, the sponsor of today's webinar, to say a few words. Mackenzie.
Thank you, Mike. And hi, everyone. We're grateful for the opportunity to sponsor today's webinar. Our company provides Knowledge Source, the leading knowledge, skills, and compliance training platform for companies with collection operations. Knowledge Source is used by our clients to simplify and lower the cost of training new and existing employees, whether on-site or remote. A problem many organizations share is considering employee development an expense rather than an investment, as you can have detrimental effects on employee morale, motivation, and retention. According to a study by IBM, employees who feel they're not being developed to reach their career goals are 12 times more likely to leave the company they're working for. Most of the folks we speak to recognize that the old paradigm of onboarding training followed by annual refresher training is inferior to the model where spaced repetitive learning promotes much deeper learning. Everyone's familiar with the rapid loss of knowledge following training events like onboarding, but by utilizing the focused micro-learning capabilities of Knowledge Source, your staff members can much more quickly master and then maintain the knowledge and skills necessary for your company to provide high-quality compliance services. Knowledge Source clients are companies that want to build and maintain a high level of assurance that their staff members have mastered and are maintaining their mastery of the knowledge and skills expected of them when interacting with consumers. And Knowledge Source automatically builds documentation of the training efforts of the company for existing clients, prospective clients, or for regulators like the CFPB. In summary, Knowledge Source will increase revenue, decrease risk, promote accountability, lower the cost of training, and help reduce turnover. To find out more about us, please visit peakrevenuelearning.com or give me a call at 803-250-3075. We're here to help make your job easier and both you and your company more successful. Thank you.
Very good, Mackenzie.
Thank you, Mackenzie, and thanks to Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. I appreciate their continued support. A couple of comments and questions have come in from the audience, so I want to take a break and ask those, but also use this as an opportunity to remind everybody, if you have a question for our panel, drop it in the chat, send it in through the Q&A, and we'll get it asked and answered before we wrap up today. The first comment that came in was, I tell folks to think of four P's, policies, procedure, process, and proof. It's easy to remember that way.
I like that. That's a good tip.
And then another question, is statement of work the same as client requirements or service level agreement requirements?
In my world, they are.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
Just read this real quick. So if policies and procedures are breakdowns of the process of accomplishing the task, doesn't an SOP do the same thing also with work instructions the same as procedures? Wouldn't this cause some confusion with your employees?
I think it's just, and Sarah, you can help me on this,
mm-hmm.
is how you break it down within your organization. You know, to me, a standard operating procedure is the same as a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, do you think so?
I agree. Yes.
Because I think the organization says, here are our policies and our standard operating procedures. And, I prefer to, policy, procedure, work instruction.
Yep. Those are the three buckets I keep it in as well. So policies equal SOP in our org as well. So, I think that it just depends on one thing you want to be very purposeful about in when you're developing these formal documents. Okay. That's the thing I want to be really clear. These are formal controlled documents that are discoverable in litigation, in examinations from regulatory bodies. And so you want to be mindful about this is our policy statement. This is why this is our policy statement. And then your procedures want to say, okay, this is how we're going to comply with this policy. These are the steps we're going to take to ensure that this thing happens to comply with these laws. Those are discoverable. Work instructions aren't usually pulled into litigation or even in examinations, right? But your policies and procedures are. So if your work instructions or you're doing your most granular detailed stuff in a controlled document, like a policy or a procedure, you might open yourself up to additional risk in discovery. So that's something to consider. But Donna, do you have some thoughts around that as well?
No, I agree with you. Policies, procedures, and that's basic for just about every organization. And then the granular part, the work instructions. If you make those known, then, if I said, okay, Sarah's the person who does this and she's got this beautiful work instruction, and then I find out Sarah, skipped steps 7 through 9, what does that do to us? Puts mm-hmm. us more at risk.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think what people don't understand, they are formal documents, but really a policy is the path to, getting rid of misunderstandings, preventing misunderstandings, like when Mackenzie was talking about training,
mm-hmm.
Small bits of training, a trained employee, an informed employee is a happier employee and it prevents chaos. When you have policies, there's no question over what your company's position or stance is on something. And then with a procedure, who's going to do it,
Yeah.
The question.
We just got flooded with questions.
I know, right? We have a bunch of them now. So, barring any major compliance or organizational changes, how often do you recommend going back and fully evaluating your policies and procedures, SOPs, and work instructions?
I do whenever there's a major, or I keep up with industry case law and such. you know, when I see something, I go, well, let me go back and look at our policy and look at our procedures, see what was, you know, what we do, what we're doing to prevent this. And of course, you know, we have a policy that says we review our policies annually. And if, you know, when changes occur, so I'm sorry, did I get off course? What was the question?
How often should you review your policies and procedures?
You know, at least once a year. And then, you know, when there's complaints and things, I'm like, so how did this happen? We have a policy on this. We have a procedure. We have a work instruction, and to see if maybe they're not benefiting us, if they're just meaningless in black and white because nobody's following them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say at least annually. That is an expectation for any certification program that you are looking for, right? Whether it's a SOC, whether you're doing a SOC audit, whether you're trying to get RMAI certified, whether that is a standard practice that you should institute. There should be at least a review, and you need to update that. So I know another question was, what do you mean by, can you elaborate on what you mean by controlled? Controlled is version control, making sure that they are reviewed annually, and then even if there's no material changes, that needs to be tracked and logged. And that needs to be controlled in a sense that only certain people have access to make those changes, not anyone. So I know in a company that I worked for previously, we leveraged SharePoint, which was a really awesome tool to help us manage all those controlled documents, right? I was the approver on some, I was the owner on some, but the owner and the approvers were not the same people. They also had a reviewer person in the middle. Sometimes those were the same. But, you know, every October for all of our certifications, I got, and I admit, sometimes I had to get more than one email that said, Sarah, get on your policies, right? But I had to go through and I had to do a review. And then if there was no material changes, I just stated that, but the annual review was completed and it was updated. If I did make material changes, I notated what those material changes were and my version updated. So there was always this tracking. So that's what I mean by a controlled document. So if you get examined, if the CFPB shows up at your doorstep tomorrow, we know that's not really how it works. Let's just say they show up at your doorstep tomorrow morning and they say, well, what happened 3 years ago? Well, what was your policy 3 years ago? You need to be able to find that. And that version control is how you identify what your policy was 3 years ago. And then if, guess what? You have a really great story to tell. If what LaDonna just said is you're getting complaints on something and you make a change to a policy, guess what you get to show? You get to show how your compliance management system is working, which is exactly what you want to be able to show them. Because 3 years ago, your policy stated this, but because of complaints or trends in the industry or case law or whatever it is, that whatever the triggering event was, you updated and made changes to those policies and procedures to meet that new risk that you identified. And that shows that your compliance management system is working as intended.
You know, like with Reg F, you know, I know that we updated at least 8 policies.
Mm-hmm.
It was Reg F.
Yep. Yeah. There was a lot of updates for Reg F. I'm still thinking of things that I'm like, oh, shoot, we should have updated this in this policy, you know?
Next question. Can you expand on the definition of a controlled document? Is that stuff like review history, locking down a PDF version to prevent editing, et cetera, or something else?
That's what controlled means to me. You know, it's locked down and you can track, you know, you have version control, any changes that were made. And then like in our CMS, we have an online CMS, only certain people are allowed to make changes. And when they do is track, we said, LaDonna Bowling on September 19th at 1:26 p.m., you know, leaves a little digital footprint there when I did it.
Where is a good place to find examples for each process for a collection operation?
I think you have to start internally, and, you know, there's a, you know, sometimes I think we have too many policies and too many procedures. you know, should I organize them this way? Do I need a separate policy for this? Can I include it in this? So it depends on your organization. You know, I know that we had as few as 25 policies, and I think now we have like 75 policies, you know, because through the years, you know, I've been asked to, you know, we have clients, you know, and then there's state requirements, you know, like unclaimed funds, for instance, escheatment policy. We didn't have one of those until about 5 years ago. So, you know, sometimes it grows.
Right. So there's a couple of resources that have examples of policies and procedures. There are, you know, I know ACA has their, it's called Blueprint now. It used to be the PPMS program. Inside ARM has Research Assistant, which keeps a library of templates from peer groups. I actually have some templates as well that I'm revamping right now. So there are places that you can find resources to at least help you get started. What I will say though, and this is really important to me because I have been helping companies for the last like 12 years write policies and procedures specifically, is that templates are nice. Seeing those templates are nice and it can help you get started. But I truly believe that you have to put a little bit of your own blood, sweat, and tears into your policies and procedures, or they will only be words on paper. I think that you need a collective effort as a company to implement policies and procedures. So I recently went to a company and they had like 5 different manuals and they were really robust. With a lot of words. They weren't very meaningful words. And then when you ask their employees, nobody knew that these manuals even existed. So that's terrifying, right? So what was the point of, you know, having hundreds and hundreds of pages of policies and procedures that weren't really meaningful at all because they weren't truly, they weren't really integrated into the business. So just something to think about. Like I said, it might help you to see some examples, kind of see how people lay out or articulate if that's not something that's your strong suit, you know, really walk through and explain, you know, what kind of detail you need in a procedure or a policy for that matter. But I will say, make sure that you kind of have to dig in and do the hard work when it comes to policies and procedures. That's what I've learned over the last 12 years of doing this. LaDonna, what do you think?
I agree. You know, back in the day, you know, I used to Google things or, you know, copy and steal everything because I'm like, where do I begin? How do I do this? You know, we weren't quite as sophisticated as an industry way back when as we are now. So, you know, I was copying like a robot, somebody's, you know, format, and, you know, I hated it. And I'm like, this doesn't make you know, but she said, this is how it goes, you know? So I had to learn that I could tweak these things to suit my organization's needs, you know? And I remember right out the gate, I started with a list and then I started with, okay, well, what categories, you know, assigning a category to it, you know, like is it compliance? Is it ops? Is it IT? Is it accounting? And then that's how I got started. And then of course, you know, Inside ARM thingy, that's wonderful because, you know, if I need a policy, I say, hey, who's got a policy on this? Let me see what you got, because sometimes you just don't know where to start.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And we do have a nice peer group in that group that's willing to share, you know, that type of information. So, you know, also, you know, really expanding your network and finding a peer group. You know, I've known LaDonna now for a while. Us compliance folks, we sort of have to stick together because, but it's helpful to just run ideas past each other, say, how have you overcome these challenges or how did you write this particular policy? I know probably about 6 or 7 years for some of the banks, it was elder abuse. It was like, how do we write an elder abuse policy? Like, where do we even start with that, right? I mean, sometimes these things come up. Remember when Equal Credit Opportunity Act was first introduced to our industry? What the heck? How does this apply to us, right? How do we even start writing this policy and procedure? So that's going to continue to happen. Now the hot topic buttons for the big banks are your ESG policies and procedures? Well, wrap your head around that. You know, like, I'm still trying to figure that one out, right? They also want to see your DE&I policies and procedures and how you're, you know, are you doing public reporting on stuff like who's a part of your board? And I mean, so these are just going to keep expanding. And so getting, if you don't have that baseline right now, or you don't feel like they're very strong, now would be a really good time to just get that foundation strengthened, because our industry is changing very quickly every day.
Sarah wins the award for understatement of the webinar. All right. Since the FDCPA and Regulation F are subject to each organization's interpretation and assessment of risk versus reward, do you recommend policy or policies for a firm's application or a statement of work?
I'm not sure I completely understand that question.
All right. Well, there's a second part. Maybe that will help.
Okay.
Should each decision made by a separate policy and or statement of work or a single lengthy, should each statement made be a separate policy or statement of work or a single lengthier document addressing everything?
I think that's up to your individual company. I do it both ways for my clients based on what they want to do, right? So I give them the option, you know, if it's a small company, it might make more sense to have the policy and procedure in one document, right? They don't have a lot of technology. They're not doing a lot of, you know, different processes. It's pretty simple and straightforward. That likely makes more sense. The more complex your business becomes, the more layers you might want to put there in your documentation, where you might want to separate out the policy versus the procedure versus the work instructions, right? So let's think about your frontline collectors for a second. What do they need? They need access to your policies. They need to know what the rules are. But where they're probably going to go if they get stuck is not your policy. It's they're going to go to your work instructions, right? That's going to tell them exactly what they need to do. That's going to give them the script that they need. Or, you know, if they remember hearing about Service Member Civil Relief Act, but they don't really remember, they know it's something that's important, but it only comes up once a year. So they forgot about it. They need to be able to find that really quick and not read through all the details of Service Member Civil Relief Act, right? You need those quick guides for collectors. But your back office support folks might go to procedures more often because they are part of the procedure. They're part of the moving of the mail. They're part of the dispute management piece, right? So, LaDonna, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree. You know, like once upon a time, we had one consumer communication policy. It covered written, it covered oral, you know, verbal. So now we have a separate policy for written, you know, consumer communication. Mm-hmm. And one for verbal, because, you know, the industry is getting more complicated. And then, you know, there are some, and I'd like to know how you feel about this, Sarah. There are some policies where you don't need a procedure, you know, like a dress code policy. And everybody in the organization pretty much needs to see that dress code policy, but I don't need to have a procedure on it, you know, or work instruction, wake up, you know.
Right.
Put one leg in, the other leg in, pull up pants, you know, et cetera.
No, that's right. So when I help companies, I usually start with, all right, let's build the foundation of a compliance management system. So that's going to include your executive management oversight, your board of director oversight, what their roles and responsibilities are, maybe your compliance management system policy. This is our policy on how we're going to have a compliance management system. But you might have, and on that, you might have multiple procedures for different elements that all roll up to it, but it's not a compliance management system procedure, right? But so then you're going to have a compliance committee, for example. Well, your compliance committee policy may not need work instructions. It just is an assertion that you formed a compliance committee, that the board gave it authority to make certain decisions. These are the decisions that it's tasked with making. This is the cadence in which they're going to meet. And this is where maybe policies and procedures are going to be approved. And this is where complaint trends are going to be analyzed and things like that, right? So those don't have to have detailed work instructions. You don't have to say, we will formally, you know, have a quorum. We're going to form, like, you don't have to go into that, like, detail. It's setting that expectation. So no, not everything needs a procedure. Some are just simply policy statements.
Exactly.
That's a great segue to the next question. And that is it riskier to have granular work instructions than not to have them? Does that open you to the consumer attorney saying, so you don't show your employees how to do this procedure?
Well, I say, okay, number one, what's your reason you have a work instruction? Because, you know, high turnover, right? So if Mike Gibb walks off the job today and his job is to process my EOSTER disputes, you know, someone within the department should be able to take his work instruction and do his job until we can fill his position, or even for training the new person, you know. And in my organization, the rule of thumb is it's a great work instruction if LaDonna can do the job. You know, if I can read that work instruction and do the work, then it's a great work instruction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think your work instructions need to be tailored to what your frontline folks need to do, right? But the entire point of a work instruction is to, yes, make sure that every single behind in a seat has something that says, this is what my behind does every day.
I always have to tell my behind what to do every day, that's for sure.
Eric made a good comment.
Yes, go ahead, LaDonna.
Screenshots are great to include on work instructions. And again, that's to break it down. So, you know, when somebody says, go to this tab, and I'm like, well, what tab is that? You know, give me a screenshot of it with a little arrow pointing to the drop down and highlight what I need to do. And that's a great work instruction. Sorry, Mike, I didn't mean to take one of your significant tasks from you.
It's pretty much the only, I'll just stay quiet for the next 20 minutes, let the two of you talk. And I think everybody would be okay with that. So.
No.
I've been putting the written out process in its own document and then creating a hyperlink to the document within the PP document to then be found on our network. Is this good practice, or should each process fully be listed in the PP document itself?
I like that practice personally. I a lot of times will link, and when I'm helping companies do this, I'll link like the laws and the reference documents in my reference document section of my policy or procedure. Sometimes I link it. Heck, sometimes I link it to ACA's search point. Sometimes I link it to, like, I mean, anything that can help. It helps solidify, right? The only problem with hyperlinks, and something to always keep in mind, is when you do those annual reviews, make sure those hyperlinks still work, because broken hyperlinks is definitely a problem that, you know, if you move something, so just make that part of your annual review that you also check your hyperlinks to make sure they're still going to where they're supposed to go. And I think you'll be okay. LaDonna, what are your thoughts on hyperlinks?
I agree. I have to get someone more talented than me to put the hyperlinks in, you know. I'll say, hey, put the hyperlink from here right here, because that's a recipe for disaster if I'm doing the hyperlink within the document. So,
LaDonna, call me. It's so simple. I'll show you.
Okay. Left hand, okay? So those are challenges.
While checking links, also make sure references to any software products are current, titles are updated, etc. Another point from Eric.
Yeah, that is a good point. I try to keep job titles might change. That is true. That's why you don't put people's names. Don't put Sarah Wagerman in your policy, right? But even systems, sometimes I don't. It depends. In your work instructions, you might say, like, this is our dialer or whatever, or log into I try to even keep that generic and say, you know, system of record instead of like the name of the system itself, to just try to cut down. Because yes, if you change a vendor out, it's often forgotten to go back and update all those policies and procedures. So
I'll use general terms like system of record and the policy and the procedure, but I feel it's necessary in the work instruction.
Yeah.
You know, log into, you know, TCN, LiveVox, Latitude, or whatever here, you know, to show it. Because, you know, I look at the work instructions are going to change eventually anyway. And then, you know, I had one process where the work instruction had like 27 steps. I'm like, 27 steps? Is this necessary just to do this job? So I'm looking at it. And I said, well, no, you have a tendency to cull too much. So, you know, I work with, you know, some people in the department, and we cut it down to like, you know, 16 steps, where it really wasn't 27 steps necessary. So work instruction can be revamped, revised at any time without any policy or anything changing if you just find a better way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's exactly right. Work instructions are always changing and being updated. That's why those don't have to be in like a formal, you know, you might have a template for it, like maybe just with your letterhead or footer or whatever. It's not going to be, it's not a controlled document in that sense. So it might be controlled by, say, the floor manager or something like that. But so not anyone can change it, but it's not, it doesn't rise to the level of a policy and procedure. Now, if you drastically change your work instructions where it might impact your procedure, that's when you need to alert your compliance person.
This is what I found. I know I do require that work instructions be reviewed at least annually, is that folks, we write the work instructions, and then, you know, the new person might follow them for a day or two, maybe a week, because they feel like they've got it, and then they quit, you know, following the work instruction. And then, you know, some smart person comes behind them going, well, this is where the mistake was. So we like to review our work instructions frequently. And I, a lot of times I'll make people within the department, or ask people within the department, not make them, change duties just to make sure that work instruction is working and they, you know how to do the job.
That's a great idea, LaDonna. Yeah.
So LaDonna, you made the joke earlier about, you know, sort of taking my job. Gary's asking the questions that I'm supposed to be asking now. So I'm going to ask the question that Gary asked, but really something I should be asking. So what would you say are the most common mistakes or pitfalls when companies start writing these documents? Great question, Gary.
You want me to take that first?
Yeah, take that, because I could go all over the map with that one.
I know. There's lots of pitfalls. Here's what is most common, though. It's either one extreme or the other. You either go so detailed and you are so granular that it's like, whoa, what are you doing? Or it's so vague that it's meaningless. You've got to find that happy medium and practice and review and collaboration with other compliance experts or people who have done this is really critical at this point, because you might get really far. Even myself, I've been, like I said, I've been literally writing policies and procedures for over 12 years now, in this compliance sense under the CFPB, and like really with this lens before we really had formal documentation. And even the way I look at things, when I think about how I looked at them 12 years ago versus now, it is kind of an art form. And so practice and review and looking at other examples of how other people write policies and procedures will help. At least that's what's helped me, right? As somebody to go, there's a happy medium here. It's kind of like if I were to ask you to take meeting minutes. There's an art form to this too, by the way. If you are meeting with the board or you're taking minutes for your compliance committee, you don't give every single little detail, you know, but you do need to, at a high level, address this is what was said, or this was what was elevated, this is what we decided as a committee, and here are the next steps. It's like you kind of got to just be really clear and to the point without a whole bunch of fluff and without making it meaningless.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that really gives you a concrete answer. I'm trying to kind of paint a picture here for you, because I think this is kind of an art form. LaDonna, what do you think?
Yeah, in the meeting notes, you know, I have a rule, omit cuss words.
That's a good rule.
Yeah,
good rule.
I'll, you know, drop the F-bomb, and I ain't talking reg F. So, you know, and what, when you were speaking, I was thinking back to when we really didn't have any policies per se, and I started writing them. I was running ops because we didn't have a compliance person. Mm-hmm. You know, when I looked back at those old policies, there was no meat to them. You know, I'm mm-hmm. like, so what does this mean? You know, that I'm like, oh, it's beautiful, nice format, you know, title, purpose, scope, policy, but there was no meat to it. At the end of the day, you're like, I don't even know what that said or what it meant.
Yeah, you really have to take yourself out of like your role and say, okay, who's the intended audience for this policy procedure? And is that intended audience going to even understand what the heck you're saying, right? I don't need to get into all of the case law and all of the reasons I came to my decision to make this my policy, but I need to summarize it in my policy statement, right? But then the detail of the policy, what is it that the audience needs to know out of this? What is the most important message that I want to get across here? Because I think sometimes we are thinking, oh, clients are asking us for this. So, or a regulator might ask us for this, but the purpose of them, the reason the regulators want you to have these is so that your people know and have a clear expectation of what your expectations are as an organization, and that they can reasonably comply with consumer financial laws. So that's what the regulators want. That's why they want you to have policies and procedures. Your clients want to know that they need to be able to evidence that you can prove that people can comply with consumer financial laws. But ultimately, it's the audience. Who are you writing this?
Hey, do you think that the regulators and the clients actually read them? I mean,
I plead the fifth.
You should test right. it. You should drop a couple of S-bombs into one and see if anyone mentions anything.
Right. You don't really have to admit to this, you know, or say you don't, but, you know, vendor management, do you read every one of your vendors' freaking policies that come in, you know, or do you think that we just have dulled our senses and regulators as well to where we're just checking the box going, okay, they have a MFA policy, they have an MFA procedure, and they're just checking the box instead of reading all of the documentation. Just curious, you know. I've never had somebody come back and say, this sucks.
Yeah, so I read a lot of policies, but that's because of the nature of what I do. And so it's really important that I actually read them. I do think that there are some, I think clients go either way, depending on the sophistication of the clients, right? I think really is dependent on how detailed they're going to look at your policies and procedures. It also might be whatever way the wind's blowing. Data security might be something they're all over right now because of some recent things that have happened. Or there might be a litigation concern at your creditor's office that they are now concerned about. So they're looking at everyone's policy regarding hardship, right? Or whatever. So I think there are triggering events that make them look a little bit harder and a little bit more detailed. So.
Yeah.
Is there a right or wrong place for an instruction or to go? Like if I put, you know, we'll go back to what we were talking about with the mini Miranda before, Sarah. If I put that in a policy or a procedure instead of a work statement, is that going to get me in any trouble?
No,
I don't think so.
No.
So there really isn't a right or wrong spot. Like if you were to look at some company.
No, I think the key really is that can you evidence it, right? It might not be in a formal policy, and that might not be the best place for it, right? Like maybe let's say you don't really have formalized control policies and procedures, but you do have a whole bunch of work instructions, right? You've got all sorts of training manuals and scripts and stuff like that. That's actually a really good starting place to build your policies and procedures. But, you know, you don't want to necessarily send all your work instructions in discovery, right? Again, so there is kind of a right and wrong, like you do need to have your formalized controlled documents, your policies and procedures, and they need to be in line with the size and complexity of your organization. But I'm not here to tell you, oh, you're on the bad list. It's just, that would be a remediation item, right? That would be something that somebody might say, or a client might say, you know, this is great that you have all these work instructions, but you don't really seem to have like policies that say this is what your company is going to do if this happens. And that might be a remediation item for you.
But is it common for you to look at a company's, you know, sort of, you know, sort of set of policies, procedures, work instructions, and say, you know, all here are the things that are in the wrong spot need to be moved somewhere else? Is that something you see fairly common?
I don't usually spend my time worried about where things are located. I spend more of my time saying, what is this trying to accomplish, right? Is this policy meaningful in any way? So whether it's a policy or a procedure, I don't get so wrapped up in the name of it, unless somebody is seeking to say, we need to better organize this, and then I'll give them that feedback, right? I am much more concerned about whether or not it is meaningful and in any way.
I'm picturing it visually, you know, like where you see like the movies where like, you know, someone goes to get the receipts for their income taxes and it's just like all in a shoebox.
I've rolled that way before search points were electronic and we had fast facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're just almost about out of time, but I did want to give each of you a chance to share what you think the most important takeaway is, or any other summary of what we discussed today for our audience before we wrap up. LaDonna, I'll let you go first.
Oh, thank you, Mike. There's no right or wrong way to write a policy. The definitions are basic, and you have to write your policies and your procedures to be unique to your organization, because what works for me might not work for you and vice versa. And I believe in keeping it simple and networking and sharing, because somebody out there has already went through the struggle of writing a policy, and you can, you know, get a copy of it and take from it what will help you and then go from there. So use your networking and your peers out there to help you with this if you're struggling with it. And then even with a list of what policies you should have and policies mm-hmm. you don't need. Keep it simple.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, LaDonna. And I would say do not write policies and procedures in a silo. Get a collaborative buy-in from your operations folks, from the team members who it'll impact, and then make sure that you establish an implementation plan. That might mean a special training, a rollout, everybody signing off that they've read and understand the policy and procedure, at least those that it impacts, right? Make sure that this work isn't in vain, isn't just a check the box, that it is meaningful.
Excellent. Well, Sarah, LaDonna, I want to thank both of you so much for being here today. This was a great conversation that had a lot of important information and insights and techniques. So thanks to each of you for being here. Mackenzie, I want to thank you and Peak Revenue Learning one last time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please check them out at peakrevenuelearning.com. Thanks to everybody who watched and listened today. The questions, the comments, always helpful, always great to see such a high level of engagement from the audience. I know Sarah and LaDonna really appreciate that as well. So thanks to everybody mm-hmm. who was here and who shared today. Really appreciate that. Everyone, enjoy the rest of your day. We look forward to seeing everybody soon. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.